Hello, I'm Caleb Howard, and this is Redemption Arc. This podcast takes stories from the Bible, Christian history, and Christian literature, and uses them to challenge the popular conception of God. For too long, people of all sorts have used the Bible to hold up outdated, isolating worldviews, changing the definitions of love and forgiveness in order to use religion as a weapon against people. This podcast will reframe the biblical narrative into a beacon of inclusivity and hope. God has thrown himself in between us and death. He has not only shown mercy on people who have time and time again made terrible decisions, but he has helped those people change and grow. No matter how badly we screw up, we are still loved and we still belong. Every single person who relies on God can claim their redemption arc. Today's episode will be the first of a three-part arc that deals with the story of King Hezekiah and his attempt to defend his kingdom against vicious invaders from without, and more insidious dangers from within. This is a story from the Old Testament of the Protestant Bible. We'll focus on four main characters: Sennacherib, an enemy general and one of the primary antagonists; Hezekiah, a well-intentioned but often foolish king; Manasseh, a reformed Joffrey; and Josiah, a reformer in the dark shadow of his predecessors. Today's segment of the story focuses on God's chosen nation, the ethnically Jewish kingdom of Judah, as it comes close to extinction yet again. Foreign invaders had swallowed up all but the capital, and its defenders were hanging on for dear life as the Jewish government was about to topple. This segment of the story, interestingly, is the only Bible story in the Old Testament to appear twice nearly word for word, and perhaps that points to its importance. I'm going to be telling this story from a very unique perspective, and the framing narrative won't exactly be biblical, but the narrative is designed to point toward the lesson that this story is there to teach. While Hezekiah is the protagonist in the biblical narrative, we'll look at this story through the eyes of the chief antagonist, King Sennacherib, as he wakes up in the afterlife. King Sennacherib groaned, rubbing his eyes. Where was he? It had all happened so fast, but he still remembered how incredibly painful it had been. Perhaps he had passed out and was now hallucinating? The only light that met his eyes was very dim. Shadows passed all around him, nearly human, but not quite. He blinked quickly. Was he dead? He was, a voice boomed from behind him. King Sennacherib jumped in fright. He turned around to see a shadowy bartender leaning against a counter that suddenly appeared out of thin air. The voice spoke again. What was his name? He sounded new. Sennacherib looked in the direction of the bartender, his mouth hanging open in shock. The bartender, clearly unable to get any intelligent conversation out of Sennacherib, introduced himself. His name was Chrysippus of Soli. Chrysippus? This was a very anachronistic conversation. Chrysippus looked at Sennacherib. Nothing that was happening here was real, and Sennacherib was focused on what time period each of them lived in historically. The former king gave an embarrassed look. Good point, he shrugged. Chrysippus told Sennacherib to come to the counter, which he did, hesitantly, and sat down on one of the bar stools. Also shadowy, but so was everything else here. Chrysippus smiled. Could he hear about how Sennacherib died? The king shuddered. Was that appropriate to talk about? He didn't know dead people's social conventions yet. Chrysippus laughed, a little bit harder than Sennacherib thought appropriate. That was the only thing they talked about down here. It got old hearing the same stories over and over again, but luckily there were always new people. Hello, Sennacherib. To show good faith, he'd go first. He had died when he was at a party and saw a donkey eating figs. Amused, he'd yelled, "Now give that donkey a drink of pure wine to wash down the figs," and had promptly died from laughing at his own joke. He was literally one of the key figures of Stoic thought, and now his death was the only thing the living remembered him for. He groaned. Sennacherib shook his head slowly. He didn't get the joke. Chrysippus choked up from laughter at the mere memory of it. "You would have had to have been there," he said, and then fell into another fit of laughter. "Quick, get me distracted. How did you die?" "It was a long story," Sennacherib said. "And the two of them would be dead forever," Chrysippus chuckled through bursts of laughter. "They had the time. Lay it on him." Well, he was King Sennacherib, an Assyrian, and he was super powerful. About a year ago, he'd started his campaign against Judah. He wanted to make it very clear that this wasn't a save-the-worst-enemy-for-last type of situation. Sennacherib had already conquered everybody who was anybody, and now he was just mopping up the little city-states that were barely a threat. Judah was a bit larger than a city-state, but not very, and its cities fell like dominoes. King Sennacherib convened his troops around the last surviving city, their capital, Jerusalem. He was pretty confident that he could take the city with relative ease, but he wasn't too keen on losing any more soldiers in the assault. So he sent the Rabshakeh to go talk to Judah's king, Hezekiah. "The Rabshakeh?" Chrysippus queried. He forgot not everybody spoke his language. The Rabshakeh was a job title, and it probably translated to something like Grand Vizier or Secretary of War. Chrysippus nodded. "Go on." "Well, Sennacherib sent the Grand Vizier to talk to King Hezekiah. It was a pretty customary thing. The Grand Vizier's job was to threaten cities to the point of surrender, and this guy was known for doing his job well. He marched down to Jerusalem, determined to add another intimidated surrender to his belt. The Vizier, an excellent orator, got right down to business and started his speech. Three weird little servants came out of the city and met with the Vizier outside the city wall, one of them writing down the entire conversation to convey to King Hezekiah. First, the Vizier mocked Hezekiah for even thinking that he had military skill. Had he looked around his city? Furthermore, if Hezekiah was relying on Egypt for help, Sennacherib had jolly well beaten Egypt in battle. There was no help there. One of the servants muttered something about how they were not trusting in Egypt, but in their god. The Grand Vizier roared with laughter. This? Now this was good. Had they heard of Gozan? Haran? Teleser? Sepharvaim? Hena? Iva? When the three servants shook their heads, the Vizier answered himself. Yeah, nobody had heard of those places. And you know why? Because the kings of Assyria had wiped the ground with them. Their kings had all boasted about the amazing power of their gods, but their combined memory was dust in the wind. Those kingdoms were all but forgotten, and the Vizier would do the same to Judah if they refused to surrender. The Vizier then roared, "Yahweh said this to me himself. Go up against their land and destroy it." He laughed uproariously, seeing the shock on the servants' faces as he used the name of their god so irreverently. "Irreverently?" Chrysippus interrupted. "Yeah," Sennacherib said. "Trust his Vizier to do the research. The Jews were very particular with the name of their god. It had to be said very reverently, when it was said at all, and could never be written down. Instead, they just wrote down the consonants. So when the Vizier said the name of their god so flippantly, the servants snapped. They told the Vizier to start speaking in Aramaic, that was his language, and not in Hebrew, the people of Judah's language. The people leaning over the city walls were starting to pick up on the conversation. They were they? The Vizier snorted. His voice became a shout as he yelled directly to the people on the walls, warning them not to trust Hezekiah. Surrender, and there'd be mercy. Rely on Hezekiah and his quote-unquote God, and the vizier was content to sit here and surround the city until the people gave in. They'd die of starvation after eating and drinking their own waste, sitting and waiting for some god to save them. "Wow, that was dark," Chrysippus said. "I bet the people from the city begged him to spare their lives and surrendered in terror at that point." Sennacherib shook his head slowly. That was the first warning that something wasn't right. Not one of them said a word. But in the palace, the poker face was all the way off. The three servants slunk back inside the small council room, ripping their clothes in anger and frustration. Sennacherib explained that this was in vogue among the Hebrew people when something bad happened. It was an expensive method of anger management, almost as expensive as therapy in the US in the 21st century. Hezekiah could have certainly used therapy, but he instead followed popular custom and tore his own clothes, loudly comparing the situation to difficult childbirth. Though the room was full of middle-aged men, they still had enough awareness to question Hezekiah's word choice. What did Hezekiah know about childbirth, and how did the analogy even apply? Hezekiah shuddered. He was in a bad situation, and difficult childbirth was also a bad situation. Sorry if it was offensive, but he just wanted to come up with a cool analogy, you know? It was his only way to cope with how bad things were outside. "And how do you know this is what happened?" Chrysippus questioned Sennacherib. "Literally, don't worry about it. Just shut up and listen, because this is where it really got bad." Hoping that he might have nearly gotten through to the king, for whom extra brutality was reserved if he refused to surrender, the vizier had sent a letter with more of the same threats and taunts. King Hezekiah tore open the letter. His eyes briefly scanning it, the king madly took off running, out of the palace and up and down city streets like a madman. His guards screamed in horror as they chased him. Had the stress caused Hezekiah to lose his mind? But it didn't seem that he had when he slowed down to a reverent pace as he rounded the corner to the street on which the temple stood. Slowly, Hezekiah walked down the street and through the gateway into the courtyard of the temple. There, he bowed down and laid the letter on the altar of burnt offering, setting it ablaze as he prayed to Yahweh. As the smoke went up, King Hezekiah begged Yahweh to make an appearance to show King Sennacherib that he was in fact the true God and that the people of Judah were his people. The vizier's confidence made sense because all the gods he'd dealt with before were simply statues made out of stone or metal. But Yahweh was different. He was real. Hezekiah begged Yahweh to show up and show the world that there was only one God. Satisfied with his prayer, King Hezekiah stood to his feet and slowly began to walk home. While strands of doubt swirled within, the king rejected them and instead thought back to the old stories where Yahweh had defended his people against certain death. Perhaps they'd happen again. Thinking of these stories brought him some peace, and on the exterior, the king looked content and calm. As he crossed the threshold of the palace, King Hezekiah heard from his advisors that one of their prophets, a man named Isaiah, was there to meet him. "Now just between you and me," Sennacherib whispered, "Isaiah was a weird guy. He'd walked around naked for 3 years and named one of his kids Speed the Spoil, Hasten the Booty. And yes, the name was nearly as long in Hebrew as it was in English. What a mouthful." Chrysippus whispered back. The Hebrew prophets were interesting characters. One had married a prostitute and named his child No Mercy. Johnny Lawrence would have been proud. Another lay on his side for over a year. There was also this one who wore a yoke around his neck as he walked around the city. See, it wasn't just him that thought this was weird. So when King Sennacherib's spies told him about Isaiah's prophecy foretelling his doom, the Assyrian king barely batted an eye. If Sennacherib had believed the prophet's message, it would have been alarming. The prophecy was an extremely detailed exposition about how God had allowed Sennacherib to win all his victories up until this point, but that the Assyrian forces would be stymied before they even attempted to take Jerusalem. Not one of Sennacherib's troops would shoot a single arrow, and Yahweh would put a hook in the king's nose and a bridle in his mouth and force him to go back to Assyria empty-handed. To Sennacherib, Isaiah's words sounded like typical stuff false prophets said, encouraging their kingdom until its very last breath. So King Sennacherib ignored the prophecy as he drew up his battle plans. Tomorrow, his forces would storm the city and humiliate that arrogant king and prophet. The troops lay down to sleep, all 185,000 men. They'd make short work of the city. By tomorrow night, they'd be torturing the prisoners. Torturing them? Yeah, it was their thing. The kings of Assyria were really brutal. King Sennacherib had fallen asleep late that night, tossing and turning in his bed and feeling very uneasy, like something was out of place. Just what was wrong, he couldn't put a finger on, but it made his skin crawl. For nearly an hour, he sat on the verge of a panic attack. Then suddenly, without warning, the feeling went away. Next thing you know, the king was out like a light. Sennacherib stretched, light seeping through the fabric of his tent. He'd slept far too long. Where were the servants who were supposed to wake him up? He'd have to execute them for their laziness. Sennacherib shouted their names, but no one came. Finally, he dragged himself to his feet and stumbled out the door of his tent. The camp was eerily quiet. Sennacherib shouted, slapping his hands against the fabric of the nearest tent. No response. Angry, he kicked the tent, expecting a yell and a curse, but he heard nothing. He kicked again, but still, dead silence. Desperately, he tore open the tent flap and gasped in horror as he saw the bodies of four soldiers, dead. The king hurriedly reached down to make sure, but the bodies were as cold as ice. In a panic, Sennacherib turned to the next tent. Again, all dead. The visceral fear in the pit of his stomach began to swell into a full-blown panic. Matters got even worse when he realized that he wasn't alone. Even now, people were pouring out of Jerusalem by the hundreds and thousands, shouting with triumph as they began to loot the enemy camp. Paralyzed with horror, Sennacherib realized that he was on the verge of being captured. There was only one remaining hope of escape. The horses were all still alive, tied up to posts. When he finally found his limbs again, Sennacherib grabbed one of the knots and frantically fiddled with it, hopelessly tangling it in the process. Hands trembling in desperation, he ran towards another horse. This time, the knot came undone and Sennacherib hoisted himself onto the horse's back, his muscles crying in protest as he grabbed the rope that was trailing from the horse's saddle and galloped away. Ironically, the vizier had mocked the people of Jerusalem for not having any horses. Yet the thousands of horses that had been brought for Jerusalem's conquest fell into the hands of the Jews, as did the food and valuables that each soldier had brought with him. The storehouses of Jerusalem became stockpiled with more riches than the kingdom had seen since the golden age of Solomon, and King Hezekiah became a fan favorite throughout the city. The people of Jerusalem bowed down at the temple, praising Yahweh repeatedly. They begged him to forgive their doubt and marveled at just how big of a victory he'd given them. The victory was all thanks to him, they knew. Meanwhile, Sennacherib's horse trudged home. Sennacherib sat on its back as the steed slowly ate away the miles. He was baffled. Chrysippus looked at Sennacherib. This was when Sennacherib turned around, went and bowed down before the Jews and asked them about Yahweh? Or at least attempted to pray to Yahweh himself. Right? Sennacherib shook his head. Why not? Sennacherib's vizier had said that never once in the history of their kingdom had they failed to defeat a god. Yet now, something had happened that was so mysterious and unexplainable that it had to have been caused by divine power. Certainly King Sennacherib was curious about Yahweh now? He absolutely was not. When King Sennacherib's weary horse rode through the gates of Assyria, his first move was to go back to the palace and vent about his defeat. His second was to throw himself down before the altar of Nisroch, his god. King Sennacherib bent down on the ground in obeisance, groveling before the stony figure of a man with an eagle's head, and begged for answers. As he sat there on his knees, eyes closed, he felt a sharp pain in his side. King Sennacherib looked behind him and saw only the grinning, triumphant faces of his two eldest sons leering at him in disgust. He barely had the strength to cry out, "Why?" But by that time, the pair had already disappeared down one of the long hallways in the Temple of Nisroch. He knew they'd get away with it now. In one last desperate hope, Sennacherib looked into the stony eyes of Nisroch, pleading for help. Then everything faded to black, and he woke up here. King Sennacherib looked at Chrysippus. If only Nisroch had been on his side. I hope I've highlighted King Sennacherib's stupidity adequately. A country promises that their god will work a miracle to save them. Immediately afterward, King Sennacherib witnesses a miracle with no explanation but the supernatural, and that miracle in fact does save the country. Yet King Sennacherib doesn't even consider the power of Yahweh as a rational explanation. Instead, he runs home and falls before his own god, a statue whose only believable claim of power evaporated with the deaths of 185,000 men. In a bitterly paradoxical twist, as King Sennacherib kneels before his own god looking for answers, he is stabbed to death by his own children. The god that Sennacherib looks to for answers cannot protect his kingdom, and it cannot protect him. But that should have been obvious to Sennacherib. We look at King Sennacherib and laugh. How could anybody be so stupid? But we fall for the same fallacious thinking time after time. After seeing something that he couldn't explain, Sennacherib looked to his culture's explanation for the supernatural. Despite the evidence that Yahweh was responsible for the divine destruction of his armies, Sennacherib didn't want to change his worldview. He was willing to reject the evidence of his own eyes and ears to accept his culture's default explanation and avoid the pain of change. Nowadays, Nisroch isn't our default explanation for supernatural events. The idea of a man with an eagle's head doesn't really cut it when we're looking for some explanation of the chaos. Instead, our culture relies on science and reason. And unlike Nisroch, science and reason aren't mythical figures that we've drummed up. Both provide a valid explanation for many things. But, though they can be legitimate answers to some of this world's questions, we tend to go too far with science and reason, trying to explain all events through their lens. Instead of accepting that certain things were caused or allowed by God, we close our eyes and ears and default to our culture's preferred explanation. That reminds me of a scene in C.S. Lewis's book, The Last Battle. I'd feel guilty about spoilers, but it's been out for 67 years, so y'all have had your chance. If you need a couple more weeks, feel free to skip ahead about a minute and a half. Now, if you're waiting for the Chronicles of Narnia to drop on Project Gutenberg USA, you'll be waiting all your life unless you become a big copyright lobbyist and go toe-to-toe with Disney. I could think of better uses of your time, but no judgment either way. Spoilers are coming in 3, 2, 1. Okay. In the last battle, a monkey basically dresses a donkey up as God. This goes a lot better than you'd think. They don't get caught because, in a scorching critique of a certain religious system, the people are told that they cannot go directly to God, but instead must consult a very wealthy, ridiculously dressed person who claims to speak for him. Many of the creatures suffer greatly because of the monkey's commands through the fake God, including some of the dwarves, who allow themselves to be sold into slavery because they are told it will please God. The dwarves are eventually warned by our protagonists that the person that they are following has nothing to show for himself but a costumed donkey. The dwarves, horrified that they had been so deceived by a monkey, now became determined that they would never be deceived by anyone ever again. In the ensuing battle between our protagonists and the false god, the dwarves get captured and thrown into a stable. There, all they see is darkness. They choke down rotten food and groan in anger and misery. Yet, in reality, they are surrounded by bright light, fresh green grass, rolling hills, and a delicious feast. but they're so determined not to be taken in that they refuse to see the supernatural when it's all around them. When our protagonists try to help the dwarves, they refuse to listen. Finally, God leaves the dwarves to their own devices, stating, "They will not let us help them. They have chosen cunning instead of belief. Their prison is only in their own minds, yet they are in that prison, and so afraid of being taken in that they cannot be taken out." That's exactly the situation that Sennacherib was in hundreds of years ago, and where many of us are today. People are so resistant to accepting God as an explanation for supernatural events that they fall back onto their culture's preferred explanation, despite its improbability. Like Sennacherib, they are so unwilling to accept some new explanation that doesn't fit in with their old worldview that they reject the obvious truth that God is behind the supernatural events in their life. The Bible calls us to open our minds and accept God as the author of the supernatural. And when accepting that supernatural means accepting that we've taken the wrong side, our duty is to change our lives to fit in with God's plan. God spared Sennacherib, giving him a second chance to acknowledge Yahweh and enter his service. Yet Sennacherib wasted that second chance, dying at the hand of his own sons, because he put his society's explanation of the supernatural ahead of his own eyes and ears. Do we do the same? Do we hold out against a full surrender to God because we wave away the miracles he's worked in our lives as mere happenstance? I'll leave you to think about that question until next time.
That's it for this story. Next time, we'll be continuing the story of Hezekiah, and it will be a somewhat happier tale. During the after party celebrating God's victory over the Assyrian armies, King Hezekiah faces a new crisis and learns a lot more about himself and about God than he bargained for.
Thank you so much for listening. Please leave a 5-star review and tell your friends about this podcast. I'd really appreciate your help sharing and growing this show. Credits to Caleb Howard for script writing and narration. Theme music is by Roa and Zakhar Valaha. Other music credits are listed in the episode's description. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.